Good morning, this is Hugh LaFave, your host for Ideas and Issues. My guest this week, I'm talking to Louis Menand, professor of English at the City University of New York, and we're discussing his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Metaphysical Club, The History of Ideas in America. Louis, glad to have you on the show.
Nice to be here.
I want to begin with a quote that you give in the book, because I think it sets the stage for what you're trying to do in the book. You're focusing on a series of thinkers, four in particular, though you look at several others. And you say that it's important to understand these thinkers because they have, quote, changed the way that Americans thought and continue to think about education, democracy, liberty, justice, and intolerance. And as a consequence, they've changed the way that Americans lived, the way they learn, the way they express their views, the way they understand themselves, and the way they treat people who are different from themselves, end of quote. I'm wondering, just to sort of set the stage for the interview, if you could pick out what you see as several of the most important ideas that, if you will, we have inherited from these people. And then we'll talk about the ideas and both the individuals who forwarded those ideas.
Well, the people I wrote about are all identified with the philosophical movement known as pragmatism, which is an original American idea and really America's one original contribution to world philosophy. And the four people are William James, who was a psychologist and then philosopher, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., who was Justice of the United States Supreme Court and a legal thinker, Charles Sanders Peirce, who was a scientist and semiotician and philosopher, and John Dewey, who was probably America's preeminent philosopher in the early part of the 20th century. And pragmatism is an influence in American life, not because I think most Americans would call themselves pragmatists in the philosophical sense, but it's important because it's the name for a way of thinking that arose in the second half of the 19th century and that supplanted an earlier way of thinking that had dominated American intellectual life before the Civil War. Pragmatism differs from that earlier way of thinking because it imagines a universe that's unfinished, a universe whose outcome is still in doubt, a universe where there's chance and contingency everywhere we look, but also one in which individuals and societies have the power to act as agents of their own destiny. It's a philosophy about using ideas, beliefs, principles, not as something that comes out of the sky, but as something that people create and that they use to help make the world a better place. And really, a lot of 20th century American liberalism grew out of this activist side of pragmatist philosophy. So the first thing I would say as a contribution that the thinkers made was pragmatism as a philosophy and as an inspiration for a lot of progressive social thinkers and doers in the 20th century. The second contribution I would name is the idea of pluralism, because very much a part of pragmatism, and particularly the pragmatism of William James, who's the first person to use the word pluralism in an English language context, is that the world is plural because there are many points of view in it. It's plural because my point of view and your point of view and the point of view of the people listening to us are all slightly different, and they all go to make up the reality that we share. Pluralism was a philosophical idea when James used it, but it inspired a number of writers in the early part of the 20th century to develop a philosophy of cultural pluralism, which, of course, is the view that the United States is made up of different cultural groups, each of which has its own distinctive perspective and distinctive set of values and practices. And that's an idea that didn't get very far when it was first articulated around 1915, but of course today we're very familiar with it in the form of diversity, multiculturalism, and so on, and it's a very important ingredient of our national self-conception. And the third idea, and finally, is the idea of freedom of expression and thought. And contrary to what we might assume, those principles were really not part of American culture until the early part of the 20th century, when John Dewey and Oliver Wendell Holmes articulated principle of academic freedom or freedom of thought, and the principle of free speech, the First Amendment law, which Holmes was really the first justice to articulate a rationale for. And that, too, is something that we come to take very much for granted as part of intellectual life in the United States and public life in the United States, but it's something that distinguishes America from every other country in the world, that we have these legally protected freedoms. And that's another thing that I think grew out of this way of thinking.
Okay, and as I understand it, too, partly from what you say in the book and partly from what you just said, is although these are ideas that have their roots within academe, they aren't necessarily endorsed or even articulatable by the average person on the street, and yet somehow you think they shape American life, pretty deeply shape American life.
Philosophically, pragmatism is the position that there are no absolutes, and that there's no truth with a capital T or reality with a capital R, that there's no superhuman intelligence that's guiding our progress through life. I would think the average American, non-philosophical American, would not accept those views. I think Americans are pragmatic in the ordinary sense of being practical, and in the philosophical sense of not feeling that they have to be slaves to some abstract system. They're not theoretical. They don't think. They don't consult philosophical arguments in order to make decisions. They tend to make them more expediently and opportunistically. And we feel that's a very good part of our entrepreneurial culture. But I think that pragmatism and the pragmatic way of thinking shaped American institutions, and that those institutions are very much part of who we are. Our tolerance comes out of the view that America is a pluralist society, comes out of the view that people should have a right to think and write and say what they believe and choose to without being punished for it. It comes out of the view that we make our lives as we go along, and that we have the power to change our environment if we think we need to do so, and to experiment with different ways of living. And I think those are all pretty much taken for granted by Americans, even though they wouldn't associate those particular assumptions with a philosophical doctrine.
Okay. I tell you what, let's turn a little bit and focus on these four central figures and use that as a way maybe of talking more about these core ideas. I mean, the book is divided into, again, looking at these four central figures. And the first one that you spend some time on is Oliver Wendell Holmes, a name that probably many of the listeners might be able to recognize, even if they're not quite sure where. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Holmes, and I know in particular one common thread that runs through the book is the way that the early experiences of these individuals helped shape their lives. What is it about Holmes that was especially interesting, important? How did he in particular help shape American institutions and ideas? And maybe talk a little bit about his early experiences and how they led him or perhaps directed him into thinking a certain kind of way.
I started with Holmes and ended with Holmes in the book because he was the most charismatic of the four people I wrote about, all of whom are really interesting characters, biographically as well as being important thinkers. But Holmes was particularly exciting to write about because he had a remarkable experience in his life, which was that he was in the Union Army during the Civil War, and was wounded three times, twice very seriously, once shot through the chest just above his heart and once shot in the neck. And the experience of the war really changed him. Now, to understand that, you have to understand something about what Boston and New England was like in the decade before the Civil War began, which is, of course, when Holmes was growing up. He grew up as a very idealistic young man. His father was dean of the Harvard Medical School. He went to Harvard as well, Holmes did, and he wrote poetry. He collected paintings. He liked to argue about philosophy. He was an intellectual, really, an academic, scholarly kind of person. But he was also an idealist, and he associated himself with the abolitionists, which was a very radical party in the years before the Civil War. Most Northerners were not abolitionists. They were unionists. They wanted to preserve the Union, but they were not interested in abolishing slavery as a principal goal. They didn't particularly like slavery, but they didn't want to go to war to get rid of it. But the abolitionists wanted to get rid of the South. They had a radical position. So young Holmes, as he was when he was a college student, allied himself with the abolitionists. He was believed very strongly as a moral position in the evil of slavery. And when Fort Sumter was fired upon and surrendered in April 1861, Holmes, who was then just 20 years old, dropped out of Harvard and enlisted immediately. He ended up in a regiment called the Massachusetts 20th. And of the almost 2,000 regiments in the Union Army, only four regiments had a higher number of battle deaths than the Massachusetts 20th. So Holmes not only was wounded several times himself in the course of the war, but he saw many of his comrades die in battle in front of his eyes. So here is a young, idealistic Harvard student who's interested in philosophy and art, goes to the battlefield, and his experience is filled with blood and horror and terror for himself and for his comrades. And when he finally emerged from the war after 3 years in some of the bloodiest fighting, he had really transformed himself, and he had rejected all of his idealism and his abolitionist beliefs, and he had become a rather aloof and cold, and some say even cynical, intellect. And that's when he returned to the law. He became a lawyer and then ultimately a judge, first on the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, which is the highest court in Massachusetts, and then in 1902 appointed to the Supreme Court of the United States, where he served for 30 years. He finally died in 1935. He was 94 years old. So Holmes's experience of the war taught him some things, and one of the things he thought it taught him was that when people are certain of their beliefs, when they refuse to acknowledge that there might be other ways of looking at the world or other people might have other beliefs, that certitude leads them ultimately to violence because they can't see any reason why everybody shouldn't believe what they believe because they know it to be true. He thought the abolitionists were like that. He thought the prohibitionists later on were like that. He used to say the Calvinists were like that. Every reforming movement that is wedded to an ideology, an absolute truth, you could say communism is like that, leads to violence because it leads people to think they have a right to coerce other people to their way of thinking. So Holmes's whole career as a judge was based on this profound skepticism about whether we really know anything. And he viewed life as a series of gambles or bets. He used to call himself a betabilitarian. We don't really know what's going to happen if we do X today, but we can bet on it. We do bet on it every day, but that's the best we can do. And the dangerous people are the people who tell us, if you do this, we know what will happen next, or this is the right thing to do. So that informed his jurisprudence profoundly, and that's why at the end of his career he wrote these great dissents in Supreme Court cases upholding the right to free speech, because one of his arguments was, we don't really know what the truth is. We say right now what this person is saying is wrong and evil and bad, but we don't know that. It could turn out in the fullness of time that this view is a valuable view, and if we suppress it, we'll never be able to recover the truth that's in it.
Okay, you said that he lost his idealism and that he came to fear ideology. And yet there's a sense in which you, in describing his life was very much concerned with ideas, it just not ideology. Perhaps you might explain to the listener how one could be very concerned about ideas and seeing them as playing a role of some sort, and yet not be an ideologist.
Well, the difference is this, for Holmes and for all these other thinkers too, really, is that they viewed ideas as tools that human beings develop to help them cope with the world in which they find themselves. And they thought that the truth of an idea is just a function of its usefulness. It has value for us because, as James liked to put it, it cashes out an experience. If we hold this idea or this belief about the world and we act on the basis of it and it works, the idea helps us get what we want from the world, then it's insofar true. It's not true in the sense that it corresponds exactly to the way things really are, or because it fits into some superhuman or supernatural system of principles or logic. It's true just because it becomes true in our experience. It works for us, and we come to believe it, and we rely on it, and it becomes part of our mental framework. But in another circumstance, in another situation, it might not work. It might no longer be true in the pragmatic sense. So when Holmes is interested in ideas, his interest is in ideas as devices that people develop to cope with the world they find themselves in, and that become, after a while, can become obsolete and have to be replaced by better devices, better in the sense of working better in the new circumstances they find themselves. Ideology, on the other hand, is the notion that your ideas form a system which has a rational or logical or philosophical coherence which transcends the particular time and place and person who uses them and in which they're used. So an ideology is something that's true for all people all the time. But an idea is something that works for a particular person or a particular group of people at a particular time. And that's the distinction that the pragmatist made.
Okay, when you say that an idea is one that works for particular people at a particular time, one possible implication of that is that there's no way at all to talk about or rationally adjudicate between ideas. And yet it sounds as if Holmes at least thought you could do that to some degree, namely within the context of the law. So, I mean, is the claim that ideas are acceptable because they're useful mean that I can't question your ideas and you can't question mine?
You're touching on some of the weak and controversial parts of pragmatist thinking. I think a pragmatist would say this, that ultimately ideas and beliefs that people hold are expressions of who they are. James thought that it was temperamental. Some people gravitate towards certain ideas because of the way their temperament is, their personality is, and other people gravitate to another set of ideas. And ultimately, the personality is more important than the ideas. The ideas are just something that appeal to people with a certain way of looking at the world. Holmes thought that ideas and beliefs and legal principles and laws are expressions of the community's will. And the community, by the community, he meant the dominant part of the community, the majority, the people who have the power in the community. Those people make their will prevail, and they make it prevail against people who dissent from their views. And after a while, those opinions become the opinions of everybody because they're enforced, essentially, by the social group. So that was part of Holmes's cynicism. He just thought of legal principles as the will of the majority, the dominant class, and that will would prevail no matter what. He thought even in free speech places, if the majority of the people thought the speech was offensive enough, they would punish the person who spoke it no matter what. They would find a way to do it. So either view doesn't presuppose that you can't argue about ideas. In fact, it supposes that people will always argue about ideas. But it doesn't hold out the possibility of some way of judging between those ideas by reference to extrapersonal criteria. It doesn't provide us with a kind of, Archimedean point to stand on in order to weigh the merits of one idea versus another. It's just each one is tangled up in the personality and the circumstances that created it and can't be detached from that.
Okay, partly because of time, and since you've already mentioned James a little bit, and some of the listeners may be familiar with James, I wonder if we might move on to talk about Peirce, who's probably of the four less well-known, at least among the public. Could you tell us a little bit about Peirce and what his particular contributions were?
Well, Peirce wasn't even very well known in the 19th century for various complicated reasons. He was a friend of William James's. William James met him when he was a student at Harvard, where James went to a scientific school and then to medical school. He didn't go to the college. And Peirce was a son of a Harvard professor, Benjamin Peirce, who was a famous mathematician. And Charles Peirce, my Peirce, was also a brilliant mathematician, and he was a real polymath. He was a logician who made important contributions to the field of formal logic and symbolic logic, work that's, you know, very advanced and difficult. He was, of course, a philosopher. It was Peirce who was supposed to have coined the term pragmatism and first articulated the concept of pragmatism, which then James and Dewey developed later on. He was also the founder of the field of semiotics, which is the study of signs like words and images and icons and so forth that have reference to ideas or concepts. And he was a practicing scientist. His particular field was called geodesy, which is the measurement of the earth. And he spent a lot of time measuring the earth and going on various expeditions. And he also went on expeditions to look at solar eclipses and things like that. He was an astronomer as well. So he was an amazing character, and he was kind of a genius. He was a prodigy. He really made advances in all these fields. He knew science extremely well. So his main contribution intellectually was the concept of pragmatism, which he first articulated soon after the Civil War in the group called the Metaphysical Club, which is the group that I named my book after. But he went on to do a lot of other things as well. An interesting character because he had a very troubled personality. And in spite of his genius, he kept getting fired from every job he had, partly because he had a rather violent temper, partly because he was arrogant and difficult colleague. He took drugs because he had a condition of facial neuralgia, which is a kind of painful nervous disorder, and he took opium and then later on took cocaine, and I suspect that occasionally abused those drugs and had an effect on his behavior. And then finally, he was a philanderer, and he was finally kicked out of his last academic job, which is at Johns Hopkins University, because of incident involving his sexual relations with a woman. So he spent the last part of his life, about 25 years, in extreme poverty. He lived in a house he'd bought in Pennsylvania, a rather huge house that he couldn't afford, and he just wrote all the time and begged his friends to send him $5 so he could buy some food every once in a while. And he produced enormous number of manuscripts, most of which never got published, but all of which ended up in the library at Harvard, where I tried to read some of them and read quite a bit of them, but there's something like 60,000 pages of manuscript. Now, the important thing about Peirce is that he was a scientist, and I think one of the things about pragmatism that's really crucial to understanding where it came from is that it grew out of developments in late 19th century scientific thought and practice. In particular, the importance of statistics and statistical ways of measuring natural phenomena, and secondly, out of probability theory, that is, probability as a way of gauging the likely outcome of a particular set of events or causes. And thinking of the world as probabilistic and as measurable statistically rather than absolutely and linearly was a very important ingredient in the development of science in the second half of the century, and nobody understood those concepts better than Charles Peirce, because of his mathematical ability and because of his scientific experience. So he brought into philosophy essentially a scientific way of thinking, and that really helped to transform philosophy into pragmatism and similar ways of thinking, which relied on the notion that life and reality are things that are subject to change and to chance all the time, and that our understanding of it has to be based on the notion that nothing is ever the same all the time, and that everything is constantly changing. No two things happen in exactly the same way. And Peirce really understood that in a deep way.
And I take it then this would connect with one of the things you said about Home, that he saw all choices as a gamble. It's just that the Peircean idea in looking at probability theory and statistics is that although it's a gamble, they're better and worse gambles.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Bedabilitarianism, the Holmes' sort of homemade philosophy, and Peirce's pragmatism are very based on the same idea about the kind of randomness of reality and the way we kind of bet on the most probable outcome. And yes, it's a very close parallel. And in James's case, he called this the will to believe, and he said we don't know what the effect of choosing a particular belief is. But if we choose it and act on it, we're more likely to get what we want than if we wait until all the evidence is in, because all the evidence is never in. And his favorite example of that was belief in God. A lot of scientists in the 19th century said, well, people can't believe in God because they have to wait and have scientific confirmation that a God exists. And James said, that's ridiculous. People believe in God like they believe in many things without absolute certainty that it's true. But that if they act on that belief, then it will become true if it makes a difference for them in their lives to believe that there's a God. So all these are kind of probabilistic ways of thinking. And as I say, really grew out of 19th century science as much as anything else.
Okay, I'm wondering if the last 3.5 minutes here, you might talk about John Dewey, since you said he perhaps best embodies pragmatism in its more philosophical form.
Yeah, John Dewey was, a real philosopher. I mean, that was his training, and that was he was an academic philosopher, professor of philosophy, and he was somewhat younger than the other three. The other three were all born in the late 1830s, early 1840s. Dewey was born in 1859. He was not from Boston. He was from Vermont. And his life course took him to very different places from the others, although he did study at Johns Hopkins when Peirce was teaching there. But Dewey, towards 1900, started talking up with William James, and they found that their ideas were quite similar, those ideas, basically the idea of pragmatism and associated concepts, and they started really working in tandem, sort of like a tag team of American philosophy, and they wrote articles and books for the next 12 years until James died. He died in 1910. Promoting pragmatism, and it was a very hot philosophical topic internationally. There were pragmatists in Italy and in England, and everybody was arguing with them, and it was a very big deal, and James and Dewey were really the leading figures. And after James died, Dewey then became a great public intellectual. He lived until 1952, and he wrote continually over 20 books. He lectured all around the world. He wrote hundreds of articles in every kind of magazine, and he promoted and represented this new pragmatic way of thinking in all kinds of areas. He wrote about religion, he wrote about art, he wrote a great deal about politics, he spoke out on political issues and social issues, he was active in the formation of the NAACP, the ACLU, the New School for Social Research, the New York State Teachers Union, the League for Industrial Democracy. These were all organizations that he was part of. He was the first president of the American Association of University Professors, which is the group that is the watchdog for academic freedom. So Dewey was the public intellectual of the movement, and it really is because of Dewey and his many contacts and activities in his long life that these ideas got spread to a whole generation of younger thinkers, social scientists, lawyers, judges, even poets.
Okay, and would it be fair to say that his public intellectualism really grew out of his pragmatism?
There were public intellectuals all over the place in the 19th century, but Dewey's form of public intellectualism was based on his pragmatism, which was the idea that philosophers have a duty to go out in the world and help solve problems by thinking about them, and that's what he thought he was doing.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Thank you, what a pleasure.
I've been speaking today with Louis Menand, professor of English at the City University of New York. This is Hugh LaFollette, Friday's Issues. Good day.